I don't know whether it was any of you guys. Al was not there in Hong Kong. Okay. Well, I don't have a PowerPoint, but I plan to make some points with Al. Okay. I think the statement I made at Hong Kong, what attracted probably Will Messenger, who's the executive director of the TOWE project, the Theology of Work project. I made this statement, that's my first point. A right theology of matter precedes a right theology of work. Now, I think for those from a Western background, you presuppose, you have a right understanding of matter, but people coming from my country, I tell you, in India, there are two opposite problems with the material world. One is the understanding that the world is a dream of Brahma, the God of creation, and a dream is a very subjective thing, a dream over against the word. So as an Indian Christian, when I read from John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word, all things were created by the Word is outside of the speaker, the dream is inside of the dreamer. So the whole idea that we are dealing with an objectively real world is so important. So in my view, my understanding over all my, because you see, let me frankly tell you, because I've not been to a Bible college, my theology was by listening to my many Hindu friends and some Muslim friends during my years in the government, because you could listen to them and you can see that they are working for absolutely the wrong reasons. If they believe really in what their philosophy has told them, they shouldn't be working at all. But for the Christian, that's why I said, the right theology of matter precedes the right theology of work. And therefore, when you read Genesis chapter 1, I think that is one thing that comes through very clearly. First of all, the created world is outside of the Creator and therefore distinct from the Creator. Genesis 1 verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. You know, having been in the apologetics ministry, I must confess to one of the sins of the apologetics ministry. We have taken Genesis 1 purely as a debating point with evolutionists. Well, that's important, but it has distracted us from many important factors of Genesis 1 and the whole underlying reality. Let me tell you something interesting. You know, these days I'm supposed to be retired, whatever that means. We are meeting with different communities, sharing this with Paul, in discussing bookends. By bookends, what we mean are Genesis 1 and 2 and Revelation 21 and 22. We are doing a study, sitting around the table with some six, seven couples, and having a meal and discussing this, because the theology of the average evangelical begins with Genesis 3 and ends with Revelation 20. We begin with the fall and end with the judgment. In fact, when I started sharing the gospel first with my colleagues, based on the four spiritual laws, I knew that I started on the wrong foot. Because when I said, man is a sinner, they said, you have such a poor view of the human race. And then I realized that I was starting with Genesis 3 and not Genesis 1. That's what got me thinking. So we are doing this study of 1 and 2, Genesis 21 and 22 of Revelation, in one sitting. One sitting means over 3 days, so that we begin to see it. That's right, you can't finish it in one sitting. So, a right theology of matter precedes a right theology of work, and therefore I think we need to recognize that this is an objectively real world which God has created. Now I'll tell you, and I want to say to our friends, we are from Southeast Asia, Buddhism. Buddhism also looks at salvation, Nirvana, as a purely escapist route. So when we were living in Singapore, we used to tell Buddhist young people who have come to Christ when they witnessed, they should never say, if you accept Christ, you will go to heaven when you die. Seems to be an escapism of the Christian kind, so they would probably prefer the escapism of the Buddhist kind. In fact, Revelation 21 verse 2, the church, the New Jerusalem, is coming down out of heaven. The direction of movement of the church is not upward, it's actually downward. This is our final destination. And I think it would be good for us to recognize this because we don't really look at those chapters. So I want to emphasize again, so there are two problems. One is to look at the world of matter as purely imaginary, which was really the teaching of the great Indian philosopher of the 8th, 9th centuries, Shankaracharya, 788 to 820 AD. He also lived only for 32 years, but he traveled right across India, wrote Sanskrit commentaries on all the great epics of India. And he was the one who talked about all reality as one monism, on which you have New Age, we have Deepak Chopra in America, all of them riding the same bandwagon. So I think we stand over against that and we say that the world is a real world. The second problem, of course, the matter itself is divine. It's an extension of the divine. So if it is divine, how can I work on it? You know, Francis Schaeffer, on whose writings I cut my apologetic teeth, so to speak, always used to use this phrase, to responsibly manipulate nature. Responsibly manipulate, because manipulate is not a very good word. But in fact, I call the Creation Commission as the first commandment. Genesis 1:28 is the first commandment, and the Great Commission of Matthew 28 should be seen as a subset of the first commandment. Whereas we have seen it as a substitute for the first commandment, and that's why I think work begins becomes almost purely a kind of a manipulative, deceptive way of sharing the gospel, rather than just living out your life in God's world. So I think that is my first point. Secondly, is the dichotomy between spirit and matter. And so when we do this book and study, we start with two verses, Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 2:7. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God, who is spirit, created heavens and the earth, which are matter. But Genesis 2:7, God formed the man out of the dust of the ground, matter, and breathed into him his own breath, spirit, and the first human being comes into existence. Which means we are the only beings in God's creation who are a combination of spirit and matter. And I think that is a hugely important thing. I mean, when I share this, because in the view that everything is spiritual, nothing material is evil, so that's where some of our Eastern philosophies kind of vibe with the Gnosticism of the time when the gospel went in the Middle East and to Europe. Not to Europe really, it was more a problem where Jesus was there and some aspects of Greek philosophy. So the whole idea that spirit and matter coexist in human beings. And then when God sent his son as a human Jesus, he puts his sanction of approval on this combination. So the first commandment can now be interpreted as this, in this way, that we as a combination of spirit and matter are responsible for the world of matter and accountable to God who is spirit. So you can read that into the first chapter of Genesis. So we stand here as God's vice regents, looking after God's creation and accounting to God who is spirit. So that important aspect, I think, is to be noted. Just a small digression here. You know, we tend to use the word Hinduism in the singular. Now, I want you to know that this word did not exist in ancient English. It is an invention of Protestant missionaries of the third, fourth quarter of the 18th century. There is a brilliant book written by an Aussie, Graham Audie, called Imagined Hinduism. Imagined Hinduism. And I think even the latest handbook, Baker's Handbook of Religions, suggests that Hinduism should always be used in the plural, because it's not just one set of beliefs. It's quite a mix of things. That's why I speak to one Hindu friend, I speak to another Hindu friend, oh, their views are quite different. You have to first find out what the person actually believes. So I think it's good for us to know that some aspects of Indian philosophy, that's how I normally, in addressing a gathering like this, I would not say that this is what all Indian philosophers say, no. I think it's some aspects of Eastern philosophies, Indian philosophies say this. So the spirit and matter dichotomy should be put at rest. Now we'll talk about dualism, and I was having a word with Al. You know, there is a duality between good and evil. I mean, that's to be affirmed. You know, India has been declared as the country with the highest number of English speakers. Did you know that? Yeah. 350 million Indians speak 350 million kinds of English. That's the problem. That's more than the population of the US. Okay. Now, the reason I mention that is that what we are seeing, there is some rules in the English language still left, because English is quite a strange language. Apologies to the Englishmen and Amics. You see, we affirm rationality, but we reject rationalism. We affirm materiality, the reality of the material world, which applies to what I'm saying. But we reject materialism, the view that the material world is all that there is. In the same way, we must affirm duality between good and evil, right and wrong, but reject dualism, which is really what we are discussing in the theology of work. That spirit and matter, for example, and I made out a list of 20 pairs of words, like transcendence and immanence, how they all exist together, but in some of these philosophies, they go to opposite sides. Let me tell you a secret. When I'm in Malaysia, I'm writing a series of letters to a Malaysian young lady who works in Singapore, a UK-trained lawyer, on letters to Audrey, chiefly on the Trinity, is the title, and they're all 5-page answers to her questions. And I'm trying to answer issues of life purely from a Trinitarian point of view, and it applies here because in the world of matter, God is transcendent over matter and still is immanent in his nature, and that is possible only because God is Trinity. Because within the Trinity, there is a distinction between the persons of the Trinity, which is why God can create something distinct from himself. But there is also oneness within the persons of the Trinity, and that's what translates as immanence of God in nature. Now, that's a philosophical take on Trinity, which will apply to the whole understanding of nature. So, it's a kind of a 20 letters. Please pray whenever you think of me that this book will come out. I would probably first publish it in Singapore through Suin's wife, and then get her permission to print it in India. So it's a reflection on the Trinity, how it affects, that's a kind of a byproduct. Thirdly, you must admit to a hierarchy in creation. By that what I mean is, God puts us over the rest of nature. Because I think in the Indian context, now you might have heard of the caste system. You abolish hierarchy in creation, you call all of nature as divine, then you make hierarchy in people, which is the caste system. The person who deals with religious things is the Brahmins, then the Kshatriyas, the warriors, then the Vaishyas, people who deal with commerce, and then the Shudras, the rest of us. And I think the theology of work is really to challenge that kind of a philosophical mindset. So an Indian Christian who takes the theology of work. So I'm publicizing theology of work in very informal ways in these contexts, so that we must admit to a hierarchy in creation, which goes against a pantheistic view of nature. Now let me give you a humorous anecdote. In an open forum, I made this point that humans are above the rest of nature, which is a mixed group. And then a person who was a member of the World Wildlife Fund for Nature, he asked me, LT, how can you say that there is a hierarchy? Because we now know that animals have a sense of guilt. If you have a dog as a pet, he shows guilt in his eyes when he disobeys you. And animals have a sense of pain and so on. Now, fortunately for me, at that time, India had launched the first Project Tiger. And I told him, you know that we are into this Project Tiger. Now, when I look at the tiger, I know that he can harm me, and still I feel I should protect him. But when the tiger looks at me, his sentiments are very different. How do you explain the difference? Now, I'm going to do this at the EFGC, witnessing to people from other faiths. I'm going to talk about crafting 21st century parables. I think we should be able to communicate the truths of God because they are not counterintuitive. And therefore we should be able to communicate this. So the hierarchy in creation is a must, and that's there in the first chapter of Genesis, because we are above the rest of nature. All that we do with God's nature is equally valuable in His sight. The moment you remove that and we say nature is all purely divine, then you introduce hierarchy in profession. So that's my reading. I need to do a little more work on that, my reading some more of Indian philosophical writings. I'm still not able to quite make out how that connection occurs, but well, I've seen it all my life. So that is there. Fourthly, the discontinuity as well as the continuity that exists between the first two and the last two chapters of the Bible. In the same way as the continuity and discontinuity in the physical body of Jesus before and after His resurrection. Because after His resurrection He could not be recognized. He suddenly appeared and suddenly disappeared. And so in our study of these four chapters, we discovered a few things. Now, as I told you, civil engineering is a very corrupt profession in our country. And I used to get quite irritated when Christian doctors would say he is the great physician and Christian teachers would say that he's the master teacher. So I was wondering what civil engineering has to do with God. I began to teach myself Greek and Hebrew from 1985 or something like that. I chanced on an interesting Greek word which occurs only once in the entire New Testament. That's in Hebrews 11 verse 10, where the writer says, Abraham was looking for a city with foundations. It's very interesting. I think there are cities without foundations. Whose builder, Demiurgos, literally translated, is public worker, PWD. I mean, this public works department, all our ex-British colonies, public works department is what deals with civil engineering. I said, hallelujah. If God is the Demiurgos, then I'm also. And then, to my great surprise and, of course, joy, I realized that the three raw materials of Genesis 2, you know, on the banks of the four rivers, you find gold, pearls, and precious stones. And what do you read in Revelation 21? Streets are made of gold, gates are made of pearl, foundations are made of precious stones. Wow. I said, who will process these raw materials to finished products? Only civil engineers. So I think it's quite an illuminating study, the first two and the last two chapters of the Bible. But I would strongly encourage, this is both theological and anecdotal, so that people belonging to both sides can enjoy this. And I think we must, I think, any questions? Yes.
You said that the Indian belief is in Maya dreams, mm-hmm. And I found in doing research that many Hindus come to Christ through healings because they see that healing is a very objective reality that's not part of their dream world. And I wonder that when we talk about theology of work, the aspect of, I sort of dislike to use this word, supernatural, but or the extraordinary, the sense of the spirit world in a theology of work is also another thing that we need to think about. And I say this because in the Asian context, many workplaces are located next to temples, some to graveyards, some to haunted places, and some people, they bring their little shrines to the workplace, and so on and so forth as well. Somebody here mentioned spiritual warfare in the workplace. I don't know who it is, but
Mark mentioned that.
Yeah. I wonder when we, how we integrate that as part of the workplace as well, part of this secular and sacred divide. You see, do we pray, when we pray for people at the workplace, do we expect God to heal the non-believers in the workplace, number one? When we minister, we witness to people in the workplace, do we expect to see the real tangible presence of God But just in a very personal spiritual sense, spiritual formation sense, do you have any thoughts on that?
Thank you very much. Because right next to the village in which Shankara lived, there is a Catholic charismatic center in which tremendous miracles are taking place. Even railway trains stop. That they opened a new railway station called the Divine Nagar, which means God's city or whatever. And therefore, I think we do see that happening. And I think from a Christian theological point of view, that natural and supernatural combine in amazing ways. In my view, the Bible is a beautiful blend of the natural and the supernatural. And I think what Satan does is to divide what God has put together. See, we go either the purely naturalist way, denying all that is supernatural, or we can affirm the supernatural in a way that God is glorified only in the supernatural and not in the natural. I think we need to avoid both extremes. Because God's creation, Genesis chapter 1, is supernatural, but some of the deists, I believe in America, do not believe in any other supernatural. So only God created the world and left it to run according to natural laws. Of course, we do not subscribe to that. And so I would emphasize that even in our teaching and understanding, we do affirm. In fact, take the story of Daniel. If you follow through very carefully, he takes a decision not to defile himself with the king's meat. But he and his three friends appear much better than the others, which is surely a supernatural act of God. So I think we need to read the Bible as a blend of the natural and the supernatural, rather than one or the other, because if you do that, you get into all kinds of problems. So I would say that God is glorified in the natural as well as in the supernatural. And I think we need to teach it and live it out. I suppose that's what Daniel did.
Sorry.
Okay, sure. I think in some ways that applies, you mentioned spiritual warfare, I think that applies in the same element as spiritual warfare, in the sense that the spiritual world is a combination of the material and the spiritual. So what we see is that either people or things also are used as instruments by the opposite side. And maybe, I think there's a whole area of theology there. But I think what I've seen, particularly in my industry, is that you can't underestimate the power of these things, otherwise you get into problems.
It's expression, I appreciate you.
Yeah, I want to say one thing in response to Mark. You know, things which are inanimate cannot be automatically demonized unless offered to the demon by a human intermediary. I think it's important for us in the Indian context to recognize, because sometimes our teaching on spiritual warfare almost goes to the point that you cannot walk on the streets of this city because there is a temple at the end. Whereas I walk in the name of Jesus. See, the whole point is, I think that Satan has no original jurisdiction over God's creation. I think that comes along with that. You see, it's because that jurisdiction is given to us. It's when we hand it over to Satan that it becomes demonized. Because I think on one side, as I said earlier, we can either totally rule out the supernatural, or we can be so preoccupied with it that we don't realize our own responsibility.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, LT. I'd love to listen to him all the rest of the time. I was asked to talk to you a little bit about ethics and cultural differences, and I'm going to share a couple of things. As a preliminary comment, though, I thought I'd tell you about an email I got last night. It came from Will Messenger, and it said, here are the rest of the documents we're going to be discussing in August, and Romans and work. There it is. No longer can you say the commentaries on the scripture except the Romans. So we will be working through that in August, and it will either be accepted or accepted next January. But anyway, we are in process, so I wanted to make sure that you understood that. I also wanted to mention very briefly a couple of resources. My wife has been involved in a Bible study process. You know, we talk about resources outside the seminary. My wife started a Bible study for working women about 13 years ago, and it meets every 2 weeks at a Starbucks. And they have been going through material and just thinking about how do we create a way of thinking about theology of work for working women who face some challenges that men often don't face. In the course of this, she has developed all sorts of Bible studies. One of the things she's been doing recently is going through the theology of work material and creating Bible studies from those. One of the goals is that she will then give those to the Theology of Work project, which will post them on the website, which will therefore be able to be used by anyone else. We really have in mind that this is a dynamic, not a dead thing, and that there will be Bible studies posted, there will be resources posted, there will be comments from the Asian perspective posted, and the whole idea is to have this grow and develop. We're still working through what is this team going to do after the documents get completed in early next year, and we hope to have some announcement on that, but we want to keep that dynamic. One other thing I wanted to mention is that another resource we have in the Seattle area is an organization to meet to allow Christians to come together once a month for a breakfast to talk about the workplace. We have speakers that come in every month in three different cities, and it's a breakfast, and we manage it all with volunteers, and any of you could try and find a way to do this in your own location, where you simply bring people together, they pay for their own breakfast, and they have a conversation. Our speakers have been interesting, covering some topics that perhaps might surprise you in view of the discussion this morning. We had a speaker talking about how to deal with migrant workers and the way they actually have done this, the programs they put in. It's a very interesting area. Bill Pollard came in to speak to us. He was the CEO of ServiceMaster, but the focus that he talked about was how do you help provide a positive work environment for the people at the very bottom of the organization, and spent a great deal of time working his way through that. We had a person that came from the company, Arthur Andersen. Arthur Andersen used to exist. They audited Enron. They failed and they went out of business. And he told the story of their failure and what happened as they went down and what it meant to be a Christian in a company that was dying. And it was a very, very moving story. So what I would say is that this theology of work is a very broad subject. It is not just about CEOs. And the Bible is filled with examples of theology of work, and it's not just about CEOs. It's about farm workers. It's about treating your workers. The document in Leviticus, which will be posted soon, has all sorts of insight about thinking about interacting with your worker. Wayne Alderson, who I told you yesterday was an inspiration for me in changing my life, the book that I read on him, from him, he told me that his father was a coal miner. And his father's work was so difficult. And he told about the time his father came home at night and said, if only they would treat me with the same respect that they give to the mule, because the workers were badly mistreated. He said it became his life mission to create an environment for workers in a steel company and a factory to change the way they thought about themselves and to represent the dignity that comes from Christ. So I think this theology of work is very, very broad. Let me say one other thing before I get into the ethics topic. We had a speaker last month who referenced this verse in Proverbs. I'm going to try and pull it up real quickly because it's a fascinating verse to read. He was talking about what does it mean to be a Christian in finance. And he read from Proverbs chapter 11, verse 1, the Lord abhors dishonest scales. We've talked a lot about corruption here. And there it is. The Lord abhors dishonest scales. Our scales can be dishonest in many 21st century high-tech ways. And the Lord abhors dishonest scales. But we skip the second half of that verse, which says, but accurate weights are his delight. Have you ever thought that when you did a just transaction in the marketplace, God is delighted? I think we can't focus just on, and Mark said it really well this morning, we can't focus just on fighting corruption, as important as that is, but we have to focus on what is it that delights the heart of God, and a just transaction delights the heart of God. That's very moving for me, and I think it's very affirming to see that God cares about the little things that we do, every little thing we do, at every level of the organization. All right, now I'd like to share I want to talk a little bit about ethics for just a moment, and I want this to be interactive. I have had the opportunity of sharing some of this kind of material in many different cultural settings, and I do believe that ethics is impacted by the culture in which you are. And I know that for many of you, this will appear quite differently than it does to me, and I think that's okay. So I'm going to start by asking you, it'll come back. I'm going to start by asking you to solve a problem for me, for yourself, actually. So I'm going to give you a case. Before I give you any tools or talk about any ways of addressing ethical issues, let me just give you a case. As soon as this technology settles down, it's trying to incorporate the new environment. You know, the systems have to collide, and it'll get there. So here's the case, and I'm going to give you 5 minutes discussion at your table to tell me how you would address this. I don't think it lights here. Maybe that. Okay. So, this is a real case. You're a tire salesperson, and you're on commission from your company. And it's been a very difficult year. Very emotional year. How about if we could pull this out? And just pull it out. Yeah. All right. We're okay. We'll be okay. All right. It's been a very difficult year for you and your company. You haven't received a commission. You need the money. Your company needs the money. You walk in to visit with the purchasing agent of a trucking company. And you talk to the purchasing agent, and he says, I love the tires that you're offering. I love the price. I love the quality. I love everything about it, and I want to make a deal. In fact, I have 60 trucks, and I want to outfit all 60 trucks, and I want to make this sale. But before closing the deal, the purchasing agent gives you the specifications for his own personal small truck. And he says, here's the deal breaker. You need to provide wheels and tires for my truck, and it can't appear on the bill. With that, we make the deal, you get your commission, your company gets a sale. Without it, the deal is off. What do you do? Have a 5-minute discussion at your table to figure out what you would do. It doesn't. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Because what we are talking about here, what we are talking about is ethics in a particular culture. I have actually had discussions on this case in Nepal, in the Ukraine, in the Central African Republic, in Indonesia, and I find that there is an interesting and different response. I want it to be your response. I want you to talk about what you, as that tire salesman, you can't say, well, who do I work for, whatever. You're the person. What are you going to do? Take 5 minutes and discuss it among yourselves. And I want to hear from a few of you after this. Thank you. I'm certain that you could take quite a bit more time on this discussion. What I would like to do is have one brief comment from each table. So we'll have to be brief. I want to have one brief comment from each table just to see what the climate in the room is. And let's start here.
We predominantly, all of us are brief that we will say no for the deal, but also we will go ahead and give a couple of stands as to why I say no. And I will also, we will also see how, without giving those bribes, we will still get the business.
Okay. I always tell my students, when confronted with a choice between A and B, look for C. And that's...
I told the group that only A and B, but then...
Right. And that's exactly what you did. Nicely done. Very good. This group.
Company, if there's any discount, you should go back to the company and not do it privately.
Yeah.
So, all things considered, it looks like global warming.
Yeah. How about here?
Well, we came up with two alternatives. The first is, yes, could we go back to the boss and say, hey, you know, why don't we include these four tires and maybe write it off as a GWP or in the AMP budgets? The other one would be, if the commission that I'm going to get out of this is 10 times more than what I would pay, maybe out of my own pocket, I would give it.
So, okay, a bribe is fine as long as it isn't too big, is what you're saying. Okay, nicely done. Next. How about you?
Well, there are two options. One was basically, you know, I say, well, I'll give to you, but it's got to be on the papers. And basically telling them that, you know, this is a company that upholds a certain integrity. We are happy to give you we give you a discount, you know, to the company, and then you can negotiate with your boss. Now, the other one we say was basically, well, I can't give you the new tires, but what I can do is I've got some non-commercial value used tires that you want, and I'll give it to you.
How about here? My point is, this must not be Filipino, because if it was Filipino, we would agree on a price that's higher than the actual price, and then we will offer to split differences.
The question is, the company that has this salesman do the commission, is the company treating the salesman justly? Because if the salesman is paid at a reasonable salary scale, he probably wouldn't feel a need to ask for something like this. If he was underpaid in order to feel that he can sustain a wage, this is the way he can honorably pay for his family and other expenses. So the question is, the person, if you are the salesman and you can win this commission, do you just look at it as a simple transaction? Well, I'm going to sell a tire to this company. What if the company itself, their structure, is unfairly paying all the other employees? What is our responsibility? And so I think we need to find out what is going on, why is this person asking this particular thing? So it's not just a transaction between him and salesman, it's a company also.
What we see in this discussion, and you've done it very, very nicely, is that this is a complex issue that's deeply rooted in the society where this is. I remember a conversation with a government official in Indonesia who said, we pay a police officer enough to feed his family for 2 weeks out of the month. Where do we expect him to get the rest of the income? We have built this into our system, and it's fundamentally corrupt. How do we handle a situation where this society is corrupt? And as we read in the scripture, I'd like to suggest that when Jesus entered a corrupt society, he had to deal with these issues. And I suggest that he took Matthew and he said, you're in this corrupt tax system, come and follow me. So we say, will you get out of it? Except then he went and met with Zacchaeus, and he had a conversation with him over dinner, and he said, Zacchaeus, you need to stay in your tax system, but I want you to do it more justly. I want you to have an impact on the society. And then the people came and said to Jesus, should I pay taxes or not? And the system is corrupt. And of course, the answer would be no. But he said, render to Caesar what Caesar's. And what we see is this is a very complex interaction of society and justice and fairness and rightness. I was involved in teaching a class at a small university in Vienna, Austria, and I had students from all over the world, and I was supposed to teach business ethics, and I had no clue as to what to do. And so I opened with this case, and I just said, I want to figure out where you're coming from. And after 2 minutes of discussion, this hand went up, and this person, he was from the Middle East somewhere, he said, Professor, what is it we're supposed to be talking about? We don't see any problem at all. What are you asking us to talk about? And I said, well, is there a little bribery here? And he said, well, you know, it's so small compared to the size of the contract, it's not anything we would even think about. So we had some discussion over the course of the quarter, and came the midterm exam. And on the midterm exam, I put this question on, and I said, what would you do? Same guy. Professor, do we answer the way we would in class or the way we would in real life? And I said, here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to answer the way we would in class, but my hope is that this will start to affect the way you think about things. The last night of class, most gratifying experience I ever had as a teacher. He raised his hand and he said, I'd like to say something about this class. You've been messing with my head. He said, last night, I backed into the car behind me and I didn't do too much damage. And ordinarily, I would have just walked away. And I found myself writing my name and phone number and putting it on the windscreen. And he said, you made me do it. And I said, no, I didn't. I said, slowly you are thinking about the impact of your life on others, and this is starting to change you, and that's good. That's really what we're about. And so business ethics is about dealing with very complex situations in a very real world, and not having instant results and saying, well, I'm going to be this way or I'm going to be this way, but how do we do it? I was meeting with a group of Christians in Nepal, and they presented this problem back to me. They said, if you buy a car in Nepal that must be imported from India because we don't make cars in Nepal, and a car that costs $10,000 from India has to be licensed in Nepal and it costs $20,000 to license it. But if we're willing to pay $1,000, we can get it licensed, but it has to be under the table. What should we do? And I said, you know, since I'm from the West, you can't ask me that question and expect me to understand the context. What I want you to do, I'm going to ask you a question in return. Have you, as a group of Christians, ever gotten together and prayed together what God would have you do as you seek to transform the society where you are? And the response was, we don't talk about these things together because we're ashamed of the way this society works. And I said, okay, then I can give you one piece of advice, not how to handle that situation, but what you need to do. We as Christians need to be praying about the very difficult things that we face in our society together, and God will grant you the wisdom to deal with this. I would suggest to you that this is a part of any theology of work. It's a part of how do we interact with the very difficult things. I think I mentioned last night that I'm very thankful that Jesus came when he did, where he did. Because if he had come into a society that was working well, we wouldn't have any insight. But read the Gospels with a new set of glasses on of how did he interact with people. He took a lot of heat from those around him, the religious people who said, you're associating with the wrong people, you're having the wrong conversations, you're doing the wrong things. But he didn't give in to the world, but he interacted with the world and where he was. I hope that this will be an encouragement to you as you think about this, these kinds of cases. This case actually didn't come from a society that is typically talking about bribery. This was a U.S. case. It was a very real case, and I talked with the owner about how they dealt with it. It was along the lines of what you were suggesting, but I do think the fact is that when you have to take a stance on these kinds of issues, you don't know the outcome. You don't know what it's going to mean to you, and I pray that God would give you wisdom in thinking about this. Let me say a couple of things about ethics. Most people, and I again loved what Mark said earlier today, most people think about ethics as what you're against and how to deal with hard problems, but it's actually what you're for. It's about compliance for sure. It's about acting appropriately in a difficult situation, But I would say that it's really about establishing and meeting the mission. If you're a business, you need to ask this question: does making this choice affect the way we are viewed as a business in our community? Because if you don't ask that choice, you get caught with, how do I argue about these nuances? I pictured it this way. Most people think about focusing on how do I avoid bad stuff, and you find yourself hanging around the boundary. But if you're thinking about the mission, you ask different questions. You say, how does it advance where I'm going? And I believe that as we think about dealing with issues of ethics in very complex situations, we have to ask these questions. Now, let me just skip past. I know I'm just about out of time. I want to give you a way of thinking about these problems. I think the first step is to just be aware of what the issues are. And you know, often it's true that when you're confronted with a situation, you kind of know in your heart what you should do. And listen to that, because I think God has planted that in you. But then I think having an analytical approach to this, and this is very similar, a little bit different from the ethics document in the theology work, but very consistent with this. Be aware of what's happening. Be aware of those affected. One of the things that I've challenged students on is, if you're the salesperson, you're representing your company. You don't make that decision on your own. Your whole company's reputation is affected, and you need to think about who else is involved. Then you need to ask yourself, what are our values? And there's a whole nice ethical discussion that Alistair was involved in writing on the ethics document that talks about the role of values, the role of rules, the role of consequences, and how to think about those things. And consider those. The reason a company has a value statement is to guide them in difficult circumstances, to understand what they are. I wonder how many churches have value statements. These are the things that are important to us that you can return to every time you're confronted with a difficult circumstance and say, does this help us to demonstrate the values that we say we believe in? And then consider the consequences, the alternatives, the potential. And here is where I like to make sure that we understand that ethics is not an individual thing, it's a collective thing. We need the community to come together around these issues, which is why I mentioned the situation in Nepal. And finally, unlike exercises like we're doing right now, in real life, you have to take an action. And when you take an action, it doesn't just mean doing this one thing. It means asking, how does this affect company policy? How does it affect how we ought to communicate to others about this? You know, as you play through these alternatives, you might say, well, the bribe is only fairly small here in this case, so it's okay. But you know, once you've established the reputation that you do a payoff, the next time you go back, they're going to ask for a new truck. And the next time you go to a different customer, they're going to know that you gave this guy tires and wheels, and they're going to ask for something too. You've established a reputation in the marketplace. You have to think about that more than just the commission on this sale for you today. One friend of mine liked to say, it's not about me, and it's not about right now. How do you project this into the future and how it plays out? Acknowledging that you, as a believer, are representing Christ and the kingdom of God here. How does this play out in all of that? And work your way through this. I have more details on this model, which I will make available to you through the slides, but I know that we're out of time. And if you want to take do we have time for one question?
Yeah.
Okay. If you want to take just a moment and raise a question or two, I'd be glad to talk about that, but otherwise we need to move on to our last topic of constructing this this statement.
Yes. Maybe you can just give us an opinion. Is that what do you mean by fair pay? You know, it's quite lofty. Sometimes it's like You know, someone will say that it depends on your performance and the value that you bring into the market. Some people will say that, and some people will say that you should not live beyond your means and things like that. How do we define this fair pay bit? Yeah.
Now there's a simple question. I think fair pay does in many ways depend on the context of where people are working. I think that fair pay pay ought to mean that a person can live with the money that they have. Some companies that I have talked with said that fair pay means thinking about what a living wage is in that country. You would probably be surprised to know that some multinational companies actually think very carefully about this. Starbucks, I interviewed the CEO and he said, fair pay means that the farmer that raises the beans can live in a respectable way in his community. And he said, we will never cut the price that we'll pay on coffee beans to the point where the farmer cannot live. He said, we do this for our own self-interest, of course. If we don't provide a living wage, they'll find something else to do and we won't have access to beans. But he said, more importantly, we should not force a farmer to work below the poverty line so that we can enjoy a cup of coffee. That's just wrong. And so I believe fair pay means understanding something about the living conditions in the area and allowing people to have a living wage. And I think that's a very contextual thing. You probably thought pretty deeply about this question, Mark, and maybe you should be answering it, but that would be the way I would think about it.
I think what I'd agree with you, corruption actually often starts
with tax collection, funnily enough. If you don't tax collect efficiently, you don't have the money to pay your people. So you have to approach it systemically and start with the root of the problem and then trickle down.
I've had some discussions in the Central African Republic about tax collection because in that country, which is so poor, in a city of 600,000 people, the capital city of Bangui, they have 18 registered businesses. That says that there's no tax collection, which says government workers don't get paid, which says everyone is corrupt, which says society is broken, and it is. So, yeah, you have to think about how you do that. The government official I talked to from Indonesia had an interesting idea of how to solve this problem for Indonesia, but I don't really like it. he said what we need to do in Indonesia is establish what fair wages would be and then pay everyone fair wages that works in the government. And then if anyone gets caught in corruption, we pull them out of their home and we shoot them in the streets. And that will become a model to people that we don't stand for corruption. I said, it seems to me that's a bit extreme. And he said, no, I haven't been able to sell that in the government either. But yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of ways. But I do think of thinking that about wages in terms of the living of the other person is very important. Any other comments for him, Ruban?
One question.
Yeah.
You mentioned about the teaching of business ethics as part of the LGA work. I'm just out of curiosity, do you teach ethics at the undergraduate level? Is it part of a compulsory course for a basic undergrad theology degree?
For the institution.
Yeah. I teach in a business school, and it's required in the business school, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. It's required as a separate course, but it's also integrated into the classes at every level, so it's something that we pay a lot of attention to. But you really do need a good foundation for talking about ethics, and it's difficult to do without that. I had an opportunity to talk on business ethics to a government audience in China, and a Christian economist stood up at the end of the talk and said something that I found very surprising and very thoughtful. He said, what was just said is rooted in a history of Christian values in America. And he said, in our cultural revolution, we threw out all of our religious heritage. What are we going to do to establish what is right and wrong here in China? And I thought, wow. I was, first of all, surprised at his boldness, and secondly, surprised at the provocative way he put that out. But it really did become a discussion at that meeting. So if there is some ways of having these discussions, both to get rid of corruption, but secondarily to think about mission and vision and opportunity for people, I think ethics is important, not just to control damage, but to create a vision of the future.
Just another comment there, because I'm sure Al would probably say the same thing, that because I've done some research into ethics and how it affects the behaviour, particularly of church-going people and so on, and the two things are clear, is that just the teaching of ethics doesn't necessarily change people's perspectives, and it certainly doesn't guarantee that their behaviour changes. It's that the research that was done across, particularly in the North American context, amongst a whole number of colleges teaching business ethics courses, was that one of the problems is a lot of the teaching of ethics is more about how do you stay within the law rather than actually how do you promote Christian ethics. But even Christian ethics courses, it's the way it's taught that has the potential to actually transform behaviour, and in most cases, the research shows that it hasn't been taught in a way that, one, changes people's thinking, it's certainly not in a way that transforms people's behaviour. So there's an area in which, in each context, a lot of thought needs to be given to not just the curriculum, but how it's actually communicated.
Yeah, and we need to recognize, too, that we are in this side of the ultimate redemption, and as a result, there's sin in the world, and it starts with us, and so all of us are prone to errors in this way, and so this is a real issue. And it affects everything. It helps, though, if the company or the organization has strong leadership that says this is something we care about. I mentioned Don Flo a few times, the automotive guy. He said that they base every promotion on where a person stands with regard to understanding and living out the values. If they live out the values, they might get promoted, but only if they engage in them to the point where they are actually contributing to the way of thinking about these values. That is what is required for promotion. So people recognize that if they go there, they may not fit, and they go away. The Starbucks guy said to me, he said, I have dismissed more people at Starbucks for lack of fit with our values and ethics than for all other reasons put together. And it takes strong leadership to say, this is the way we're going to do things, in spite of the fact that people have been trained. That's not enough. There needs to be some kind of factor that says, this is the way you do it. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.